find any such beast on the ice of the out-islands, and I told him, truthfully, that I expected to be bored and uncomfortable for much of the journey, but not at risk. I was, after all, only a minor guardsman, honoured to be chosen to accompany the prince. Doubtless I would spend most of my time waiting for someone to tell me what to do. We laughed together over that, and I hoped he had taken my point, that obeying one's superior was not a childish limit, but a duty that any man could expect in his life. But if he saw it in that light, he made no mention of it. We did not linger over our meal. The food didn't warrant it, and I sensed that Hap was anticipating his assignation with Svanja. Whenever I thought of it, my heart sank. But I knew there was no turning him aside from it. So when our hasty meal was finished, we pushed away our greasy plates and left the stuck pig. We walked together for a short time, watching evening creep up on Buckkeep Town. When I was a boy, the streets would have been near empty at this hour. But Buckkeep Town had grown, and the duskier trades of the city had increased. At a well-traversed crossroad, women lingered on the streets, walking slowly. They eyed the passing men, speaking desultorily to one another as they waited to be approached. There Hap halted. "I have to go now," he said quietly. I nodded, forbearing to make any comment. I took the purse I'd prepared out of my jerkin and slipped it to him. "Don't carry it all about with you, but only what you think you'll need that day. Do you have a safe place to put the rest?"
"Thank you, Tom."
He took it gravely, tucking it inside his shirt.
"I do. At least, Svanja does. I'll have her keep it for me."
It took every bit of control and deception that I'd ever learned to keep my misgivings from showing in my eyes or my face. I nodded as if I had no doubt all would be well. Then I embraced him briefly as he bid me to be careful on my journey, and we parted. I found I did not want to return to Buckkeep Castle yet. It had been an unsettling day, between Webb's words and Hap's news, and the food I'd eaten at the Stuck Pig had more dismayed than satisfied my belly. I suspected it would not stay with me long. So I turned a different way from Hap, lest he think I followed him and wandered for a time through the streets of Buckkeep. Restlessness vied with loneliness. I found myself passing the tailor shop that had once been a chandlery where Molly had worked. I shook my head at myself and deliberately set out for the docks. I wandered up and down them for a time, tallying to myself how many out-island ships, how many from Bingtown or Jamalia and beyond, and how many were our own vessels. The docks were longer and more crowded than my boyhood recollection of them, and the number of foreign ships was equal to our own. As I passed a vessel, I heard an out-islander shout a gruff jest to his fellows and their raucous replies. I was pleased with myself that I could follow their words. The ships that would bear us to the out-islands were tied up at the main docks. I slowed to stare up at their bare rigging. The loading of them had ceased for the night, but men kept watch on their decks by lantern light. The ships looked large now. I knew how small they would become after a few days at sea. In addition to the ship that would carry the prince and his selected entourage, there were three ships that would carry lesser nobles and their baggage, and a cargo of gifts and trade items. The ship Prince Dutiful would sail on was called the Maiden's Chance. She was an older ship, proven swift and seaworthy. Now that she had been scrubbed and her paint and canvas completely renewed, she looked like a new creation. As a merchant vessel, built for carrying cargo, speed had been traded for capacity and stability. Her hull was as rounded as the belly of a pregnant sow. Her forecastle had been enlarged to provide adequate housing for her noble guests. She looked top-heavy to me, and I wondered if her master approved of the changes that had been made for Dutiful's comfort. I would travel aboard her, along with the rest of the prince's guard. I wondered idly if Chade would wrangle quarters for me, or if I would have to make do with whatever space I could claim for myself, as guardsmen usually did. Useless to wonder, I told myself. Whatever would be, and I'd have to deal with it as it came. I sourly wished there was no journey to make. I could recall a time when a journey anywhere was something I anticipated eagerly. I'd awake on the day of departure at dawn, full of enthusiasm for the adventure to come. I'd be ready to depart when others were still crawling sleepily from their blankets. I didn't know when I had lost that ebullience for travel, but it was definitely gone. I felt not excitement, but a growing dread, just the thought of the sea voyage to come, The days spent in cramped quarters as we sailed east and north was enough to make me wish I could back out of the expedition. I did not even allow my mind to stray beyond it, into the doubtful welcome of the out-islanders and our extended stay in their cold and rocky region. Finding a dragon trapped in ice and chopping its head off was beyond my imagining. Near nightly I muttered to myself over the Narcheska's strange choice of this task for the prince, to prove himself worthy of her hand. Over and over I had tried to find a motive that would make it comprehensible. None came to me. Now, as I walked the windy streets of Buckkeep, I prodded again at my greatest dread. Most of all, I feared that moment when the fool would discover I had divulged his plans to Chade. Although I had done my best to mend my quarrel with the fool, I had spent little time with him since then. In part, I avoided him lest some look or gesture of mine betray my treachery. Yet most of it was the fool's doing. Lord Golden, as he now styled himself, had recently changed his demeanour considerably. Previously, his wealth had allowed him to indulge himself in an extravagant wardrobe and exquisite possessions. Now, he flaunted it in ways more vulgar. He disposed of coin like a servant shaking dirt from a duster. In addition to his chambers in the keep, he now rented the entire upper floor of the Silver Key, a town inn much favoured by the well-to-do. This fashionable establishment clung like a limpet to a steep site that would have been considered a poor building location in my boyhood days. Yet from that lofty perch, one could gaze far out over both the town and the water beyond. Within that establishment, Lord Golden kept his own cook and staff. Rumours of the rare wines and exotic dishes he served made his table clearly superior to the Queen's own. While he dined with his chosen friends, the finest of six duchies' minstrels and entertainers vied for his attention. It was not unusual to hear that he had invited a minstrel, a tumbler, and a juggler to perform simultaneously, in different corners of the dining chamber. Such meals were invariably preceded and followed by games of chance, with the stakes set sufficiently high that only the wealthiest and most spendthrift of young nobles could keep pace with him. He began his days late, and his nights finished with the dawn. It was also rumoured that his palate was not the only sense he indulged. Whenever a ship that had stopped in Bingtown or Jamalia or the Pirate Isles docked, it was certain to bring him a visitor. Tattooed courtesans, former Jamalian slaves, slender boys with painted eyes, women who wore battle dress and hard-eyed sailors came to his door, stayed closeted within his chambers for a night or three, and then departed on the ships again. Some said they brought him the finest smoke herbs, as well as Sindin, a Jamalian vice recently come to Buckkeep. Others said they came to provide indulgence for his other Jamalian tastes. Those who dared to ask about his guests received only an arch look or a coy refusal to answer. Strange to say, his excesses seemed only to increase his popularity with a certain segment of the Six Duchies' aristocracy. Many a noble youth was sternly called home from Buckkeep, or received a visit from a parent suddenly concerned about the amount of coin it was taking to keep a youngster at court. Amongst the more conservative, there was grumbling that the foreigner was leading Buckkeep's youth astray. But what I sensed more than disapproval was a salacious fascination with Lord Golden's excesses and immorality. One could trace the embroidery of the tales about him as they moved from tongue to tongue. Yet at the base of each gossip tree was a root that could not be denied. Golden had moved into a realm of excess that no other had approached since Prince Regal had been alive. I could not comprehend it, and that troubled me greatly. In my lowly role of Tom Badgerlock, I could not call openly on such a lofty creature as Lord Golden, and he did not seek me out. Even when he spent the night in his Buckkeep castle chambers, he filled them with guests and entertainers until the sky was greying. Some said he had shifted his dwellings to Buckkeep town to be closer to those places that featured games of chance and depraved entertainment, but I suspected he had moved his lair to be away from Chade's observations, and that his foreign overnight guests were not for his physical amusement, but rather spies and messengers from his friends to the south. What tidings did they bring him, I wondered, and why was he so intent on debasing his reputation and spending his fortune? What news did he give them to bear back to Bingtown and Jamalia? But those questions were like my ponderings on the Narcheska's motivation for setting Prince Dutiful to slay the dragon Icefire. There were no clear answers, and they only kept my thoughts spinning wearily during hours that would have been better spent in sleep. I looked up at the latticed windows of the Silver Key. My feet had brought me here with no guidance from my head. The upper chambers were well lit this night, and I could glimpse passing guests within the opulent chambers. On the sole balcony, a woman and a young man conversed animatedly. I could hear the whine in their voices. They spoke quietly at first, but then their tones rose in altercation. I knelt down as if fastening my shoe and listened.
"I've a wonderful opportunity to empty Lord Verdant's purse, but only if I have the money to set on the table to wager. Give me what you owe me now!"
the young man demanded of her.
"I can't,"
the woman spoke in the careful diction of one who refuses to be drunk.
"I don't have it, laddie, but I soon will. When Lord Golden pays me what he owes me from his gaming yesterday, I'll get your coin to you. Had I known you were going to be so usurious about it, I never would have borrowed it from you."
The young man gave a low cry between dismay and outrage.
"When Lord Golden pays you his wager, that's as well as to say never. All know he's fallen behind in his debts. Had I known you were borrowing from me to wager against him, I'd never have loaned it."
"You flaunt your ignorance,"
she rebuked him after a moment of shocked silence.
"All know his wealth is bottomless. When the next ship comes in from Jamalia, he will have coin enough to pay us all."
From the shadows at the corner of the inn, I watched and listened intently.
"If the next ship comes in from Jamalia, which I doubt from the way the war is going for them, it would have to be the size of a mountain to bring enough coin to pay all he owes now. Haven't you heard that he is even behind on his rent, and that the landlord only lets him stay on because of the other business he brings here?"
At his words, the woman turned from him angrily, but he reached out to seize her wrist.
"Listen, you stupid wench, I warn you. I won't wait long for what is owed me. You'd best find a way to pay me, and tonight."
He looked her up and down, and added huskily,
"Not all of it need be in coin."
"Ah, Lady Heliotrope, there you are. I've been looking for you, you little minx. Have you been avoiding me?"
The leisurely tones of Lord Golden wafted down to me as he emerged onto the balcony. The light from behind him glanced off his gleaming hair and limned his slender form. He stepped to the edge of the balcony. Leaning lightly on the rail, he gazed out over the town below him. The man immediately released the woman's wrist, and she stepped back from him with a toss of her head and went to join Lord Golden at his vantage point. She cocked her head at him and sounded like a tattling child as she complained,
"Dear Lord Golden, Lord Capable has just told me that there is little chance you will pay me our wager. Do tell him how wrong he is."
Lord Golden lifted one elegant shoulder.
"How rumours do fly, if one is but a day or so late in honouring a friendly wager. Surely one should never bet more than one can afford to lose, or afford to do without until paid. Don't you agree, Lord Capable?"
"Or perhaps that one should not wager more than one can immediately afford to pay,"
Lord Capable suggested snidely.
"Dear, dear. Would not that limit our gaming to whatever a man could carry in his pockets? Small stakes, those. In any case, sweet lady, why do you think I was seeking you, if not to make good our bet? Here I think you will find a good part of what I owe you. I do hope you won't mind if it is in pearls rather than coin."
She tossed her head, dismissing the surly Lord Capable.
"I don't mind at all. And if there are those that do, well, then they should simply be content to wait for crass coin. Gaming should not be about money, dear Lord Golden." "Of course not. The risk is the relish, as I say, and the winning is the pleasure. Don't you agree, Capable?"
"And if I did not, would it do me any good?"
Capable asked sourly. He and I had both noticed that the woman made no immediate effort to pay him his due. Lord Golden laughed aloud, the melodic sound cutting the cool air of the spring night.
"Of course not, dear fellow. Of course not. Now, I hope both of you will step within and sample a new wine with me. Standing out here in this chill wind, a man could catch his death of cold. Surely friends can find a warmer place to speak privately."
The others had already turned to re-enter the well-lit chamber. Yet Lord Golden paused a moment longer and gazed pensively at the spot where I had thought myself so well concealed. Then he inclined his head slightly to me, before he turned and departed. I waited a few moments longer, then stepped from the shadows. I felt annoyed with him, because he had noticed me so effortlessly, and because his offer to meet me somewhere else had been too vague for me to comprehend. Yet as much as I longed to sit down and talk with him, greater was my dread that he would uncover my treachery. Better, I decided, to avoid my friend, than to have to confront that in his eyes. I strode sullenly through the dark streets, alone. The night wind on the back of my neck chilled me as it pushed me back towards Buckkeep Castle.
Chapter 3. Trepidation. Then Hokin was enraged with those who questioned his treatment of his catalyst, and he resolved to make a show of his authority over her. "Child she may be," he declared, "and yet the burden is hers, and it must be borne, and nothing must make her question her role, or sway her to save herself at the expense of condemning the world." And then he required of her that she go to her parents and deny them both, saying, "I have no mother, I have no father, I am only the catalyst of the White Prophet Hokin." And further she must say, "I give you back the name you gave me. I am Redda no longer, but Wild Eye, as Hokin has made me." For he had named her thus for her one eye that always peered to one side. This she did not wish to do. She wept as she went, she wept as she spoke the words, and she wept as she returned. For 2 days and 2 nights the tears did not cease to flow from her eyes, and he allowed her this morning. Then Hokin said to her, "Wild Eye, cease your tears." And she did, because she must. Scribe Catarin, of the White Prophet Hokin. When a journey is 12 days away, that can seem plenty of time to put all in readiness. Even at 7 days away it seems possible that all preparations will be completed on time. But as the days dwindle to 5 and 4, and then 3, the passing hours burst like bubbles, and tasks that seemed simple suddenly become complex. I needed to pack all I would require to be assassin, spy, and skillmaster, while appearing to carry only the ordinary gear of a guardsman. I had farewells to make, some simple, and some difficult. The only part of the trip that I could look forward to with pleasure was our eventual return to Buckkeep. Dread can weary a man more than honest labour, and mine built with each passing day. 3 nights before we were to sail, I felt exhausted and half sick with it. That tension woke me long before dawn and denied me any more sleep. I sat up. The embers in the tower room's fireplace illuminated little more than the shovel and poker leaning to one side of the hearth's mouth. Then my eyes slowly adjusted to the gloom of the windowless chamber. It was a place familiar to me from my days as the assassin's apprentice. Little had I thought that I would ever make it my own. I rose from Chade's old bed, leaving behind the nightmare-rucked blankets and the warmth of sleep. I padded over to the fireplace and added a small log. I hung a pot of water from the hook and swung it over the low flames. I thought of putting on a kettle for tea, but felt too weary still. I was too worried to sleep, and too tired to admit that I was now awake for the day. It was a miserable place, one that had become achingly familiar as our departure date grew closer. I kindled a taper from the fire's dancing flames. I lit the waiting candles in the branched candelabrum on the scarred old work-table. The chair was cold beneath me as I sat down with a groan. I sat at the work-table in my nightshirt and stared at the various charts I had assembled last night. They were all of Out-Islander origin, but so varied in size and composition that it was difficult to see their relationship to one another. It is their peculiar custom that charts of the sea can only be made on sea mammal or fish skin. I suspected these charts had been cured in urine, for they had a peculiar and clinging odour. Out-island custom also decrees that each island must be presented as one of their god's runes on its own chart. This means that there were curious flourishes and fillips on the representations that had nothing to do with the island's physical characteristics. These additions had great significance to an out-islander, denoting what anchorage or currents might be present, and if the luck of an island were good, bad or neutral. For me, the embellishments were only confusing. The four scrolls I had obtained were drawn by different hands and to different scales. I had spread them out on the table in their approximate relation to each other, yet they still gave me only a hazy idea of the distance we would cross. I traced our route from chart to chart, with the burns and circles on the old table's top representing the unknown dangers and seas that lay between them. We would sail first from Buckkeep Town to Skyreen. It was not the largest of the out-islands, but it boasted the best port and the most arable land of the isles, and hence the largest population. Piotr, mother-brother to the Narcheska, had spoken of Zilig with disdain. He had explained to Chade and Katrikan that Zilig, the busiest out-island port, had become a haven for all sorts of folk. Foreigners came there to visit and trade, and in Piotr's opinion far too many stayed, bringing their crude customs with them. It was also a supply port for the vessels that came north to hunt sea mammals for hides and oil, and those rough crews had corrupted many an out-islander youth and maiden. He made Zilig sound like a dingy and dangerous port town, with the flotsam and jetsam of humanity making up a good part of its population. There we would dock first. Archon Bloodblade's mother house was on the other side of Skyreen, but they had a strong house in Zilig for when they visited there. Here we would meet with the Hetgerd, a loose alliance of out-islander headmen, for a discussion of our quest. Chade and I were both leery of that event. Chade anticipated resistance to the marriage alliance, and perhaps to our quest. To some out-islanders, Icefire was a guardian spirit to those islands. Our quest to chop off his head might not be well received. When our meeting at Zilig was complete, we would transfer from our six duchies vessel to an out-islander ship, one more suited to the shallow waters we must next negotiate, with a captain and crew that knew the channels. They would take us to Wyslington, on mail, the home island for Eliania and Piotr's Narwhal clan. Dutiful would be presented to her family and welcomed to her mother house. There would be celebrations of the betrothal and advice for the prince on the task that lay before him. After our visits to their home village, we would return to Zilig and there take ship for Aslevial, and the dragon trapped in a glacier. Impulsively, I swept the charts aside. Folding my arms, I put my brow down on my crossed wrists and stared into the darkness trapped there. My guts were cramped with dread. It wasn't just the voyage ahead. There were other hazards to be negotiated before we even set foot on the ship. The skill coterie had still not mastered their magic. I suspected that despite my warnings, Dutiful and his friend Lord Sybil were using the wit magic, and that the prince would be caught. Too often, the openly witted were his companions these days. Even if the queen had decreed there was no shame to possessing such magic, the common folk and her nobles still despised practitioners of the beast magic. He risked himself, and perhaps the betrothal negotiations. I had no idea how the out-islanders felt about the wit magic. Around and around, my thoughts chased themselves, with no escape from worry. Hap was still dangling after Svanja, and I dreaded leaving him to his own devices. The few times my dreams had brushed nettles, she had seemed both secretive and anxious. Swift seemed to become more intractable by the day. I'd be relieved to leave that responsibility, but worried what would become of him in my absence. I still hadn't told Che that Webb knew who I was, or discussed that information with Webb. My desperate longing for someone to confide in only made me more aware of how isolated I had become. I missed my wolf night eyes, as I would miss my heart's beating. When my forehead thumped solidly against the table, I came back to wakefulness abruptly. The sleep that had evaded me in my bed had captured me sitting at the work table. With a sigh, I sat up straight, rolled my shoulders, and resigned myself to the day. There were tasks to accomplish, and little time to do them in. Once we were on the ship, I'd have plenty of time to sleep, and even more time for fruitless worrying. Few things were as boring to me as an extended journey at sea. I rose and stretched. It would soon be dawn. Time to get dressed and go to the Queen's garden for the morning's lesson with Swift. The water in the pot had almost boiled away while I dozed. I mixed it with cold in the washbasin, made my ablutions, and dressed for the day. A plain leather tunic went on over my shirt and trousers of buck blue. I pulled on soft boots and forced my cropped hair into a stubby warrior's tail. After my session with Swift, I'd be meeting the skill coterie for another shared lesson. I wasn't anticipating it with pleasure. As each day passed, we made improvement, but it was not sufficient to satisfy Chade. He saw his slow progress as failure. His frustration had become a palpable and discordant force whenever we came together. Yesterday I had noticed that Thick feared to meet the old man's eyes, and that Dutiful's pleasant expression had a fixed desperation to it. I had spoken privately to Chade, asking him to be more self-forgiving and more tolerant of the rest of the coterie's vulnerabilities. He had taken my request as a rebuke, and only become more grimly self-contained in his fury. It had not lessened any of the tension. "Fitz," someone said softly, and I spun, startled. The fool stood framed in the doorway that was usually concealed by the wine rack. He could move more silently than anyone else I had ever known. Coupled with that, he was undetectable to my wit sense. Sensitive as I was to the presence of other living beings, he alone had the ability to take me completely by surprise. He knew it, and I think he enjoyed it. He smiled apologetically as he advanced into the room. His tawny hair was bound sleekly back, and his face was innocent of Lord Golden's paint. Baird, his face was more bronze than I had ever seen it. He wore Golden's foppish dressing gown, but it seemed a bizarre costume when he dropped the Lord's elaborate mannerisms. Never before had I known him to venture here without an invitation. "What are you doing here?" I blurted out, and then added more courteously, "though I am glad to see you." "Ah, I had wondered if you would be. When I saw you lurking beneath my window, I thought you wanted to meet. I sent Chade an oblique message for you the next day, but heard no response, so I decided to make it easy for you." "Yes, well, do come in." His sudden appearance, coupled with the disclosure that Chade had not relayed his message to me, rattled me. "It's not the best time for me. I'm supposed to be meeting Swift soon, in the Queen's garden, but I've a few moments to spare. Should I put on the kettle for tea?" "Yes, please, if you've the time. I don't wish to intrude. I know we've all much to do in these last few days." Then his words stopped abruptly, and he stared at me, the smile fading from his face. "Listen to how awkward we've become. So polite, and so careful not to give offence." He drew a long breath, then spoke with uncharacteristic bluntness. "After I sent a message and heard nothing back, the silence began to trouble me. I know we've had our differences lately. I thought we had mended them, but I began to have doubts. This morning I decided I'd confront them, so here I am." "Did you want to see me, Fitz? Why didn't you answer my message?" His sudden change in tone further unbalanced me. "I didn't receive your message. Perhaps Chade misunderstood or forgot. He has had many concerns lately." "And the other night, when you came to my window?" He walked over to the hearth, dipped fresh water into the kettle from the bucket, and put it back over the flame. As he knelt to poke up the fire and add a bit of wood, I felt grateful I didn't have to meet his eyes. "I was just strolling about Buckkeep Town, chewing over my own problems. I hadn't really planned to try to see you. My feet just carried me that way." It sounded awkward and stupid, but he nodded quietly. The awareness of our mutual discomfort was a wall between us. I had done my best to patch our quarrel, but the memory of that rift was still fresh with both of us. Would he think I avoided his eyes to hide some hidden anger from him? Or would he guess at the guilt I tried to conceal?
your own problems?
He asked quietly as he rose, dusting his hands together, and I was glad to seize on the topic. Telling him of my woes with Hap seemed by far the safest thing we could discuss. And so I confided my worries about my son to him, and in that telling regained our familiarity. I found tea herbs for the bubbling water, and toasted some bread that was left over from my last night's repast. He listened well, as he bundled my charts and notes to one end of the table. By the time my words had run out, he was pouring steaming tea from a pot into two cups that I had set out. The ritual of putting out food reminded me of how easily we had always worked together. Yet somehow that hollowed me even more when I thought of how I deceived him. I wished to keep him away from Asleveal because he believed he would die there. Chade aided me because he did not want the fool interfering in the prince's quest. Yet the result was the same. When the day came for us to sail, the fool would suddenly discover that he was not to be one of the party. And it was my doing. Thus my thoughts wrapped me, and silence fell as we took our places. He lifted his cup, sipped from it, and then said, "It isn't your fault, Fitz. He has made a decision, and no words or acts of yours will change it now." For one brief instant, he seemed to be replying to my thoughts, and the hair stood up on the back of my neck because he knew me so well. Then he added, "Sometimes all a father can do is stand by and witness the disaster, and then pick up the pieces." I found my tongue and replied, "My worry, fool, is that I won't be here to witness it or to pick up the pieces. What if he gets into real trouble and there's no one to step in on his behalf?" He held his teacup in both hands and looked at me over it. "Is there no one staying behind that you can ask to watch over him?" I suppressed an impulsive urge to say, "How about you?" I shook my head. "No one that I know well enough. A Catrican will be here, of course, but it would hardly be appropriate to ask the Queen to play such a role to a guardsman's son. Even if Jinnah and I were still on good terms, I no longer trust her judgment." In dismay, I added, "Sometimes it's a bit daunting to realize how few people I really trust, or even know well, as Tom Badgerlock, I mean." I fell silent for a moment, considering that. Tom Badgerlock was a facade, a mask I wore daily, and yet I'd never been truly comfortable being him. I felt awkward deceiving good people such as Wim or Laurel. It made a barrier to any real friendship. "How do you do it?" I asked the fool suddenly. "You shift who you are from year to year and place to place. Don't you ever feel regret that no one truly knows you as the person you were born?" He shook his head slowly. "I am not the person I was born. Neither are you. I know no one who is. Truly, Fitz, all we ever know are facets of one another. Perhaps we feel as if we know one another well when we know several facets of that person. Father, son, brother, friend, lover, husband. A man can be all of those things, yet no one person knows him in all those roles. I watch you being Hap's father, and yet I do not know you as I knew my father. Any more than I knew my father as his brother did. So, when I show myself in a different light, I do not make a pretense. Rather, I bear a different aspect to the world than they have seen before. Truly, there is a place in my heart where I am forever the fool and your playfellow. And within me there is a genuine Lord Golden, fond of good drink and well-prepared food and elegant clothing and witty speech. And so, when I show myself as him, I am deceiving no one, but only sharing a different part of myself."
"And Amber?" I asked quietly. Then I wondered that I had dared venture the question. He met my gaze levelly.
"She is a facet of me. No more than that, and no less."
I wished I had not brought it up. I levered the conversation back into its old direction. "Well, that solves nothing for me, as far as finding someone to watch over Hap for me." He nodded, and again there was a stiff little silence. I hated that we had become so self-conscious with one another, but could not think how to change it. The fool was still my old friend from my boyhood days, and he wasn't. Knowing that he had other facets
reordered all my ideas of him. I felt trapped, wanting to stay and ease our friendship back into its old channel, yet also wanting to flee. He sensed it, and excused me. "Well, I regret that I came at a bad time. I know you have to meet Swift soon. Perhaps we shall have a chance to speak again before we sail." "He can wait for me," I heard myself say suddenly. "It won't hurt him a bit." "Thank you," he said. And then again our conversation lapsed. He saved it by picking up one of the furled charts. "Is this Aslevial?" he asked as he unrolled it on the table. "No, that's Skyrene. Our first port of call is at Zillig." "What's this over here?" He pointed to a curling bit of scrollwork on one shore of the island. "Out-islander ornamentation, I think. Or maybe it means a whirlpool, or a switching current, or seaweed beds, I don't know. I think they see things differently from us."
"Undoubtedly so. Have you a chart of Aslevial?"
"The smaller one, with the brown stain at one end." He unrolled it next to the first, and glanced from one to the other.
"I see what you mean," he murmured, tracing an impossibly lacy edge on the shoreline. "What do you think that is?"
"Melting glacier. At least that is what Chade thinks."
"I wonder why he didn't give you my message."
I feigned ignorance. "As I said, perhaps he forgot. When I see him today, I'll ask him.
Actually, I'd like to speak to him as well. Privately. Perhaps I could come with you to your skill lesson today."
I felt extremely uncomfortable, yet I could think of no way to wriggle out of inviting him. "That's not until afternoon today, after Swift's lessons and weapon practice." He nodded, unconcerned.
"That would be fine. I've things to tidy up in my chamber below."
As if inviting me to ask why, he added, "I've nearly moved out of those rooms completely.
There won't be much left for anyone to trouble about."
"So you intend to move to the Silver Key permanently?" I asked. For a moment his face went blank. I had surprised him. Then he shook his head slowly at me, smiling gently.
"You never believe a thing I tell you, do you, Fitz?" "Ah, well, perhaps that has sheltered us both through many a storm. No, my friend, I will leave my buckkeep chambers empty when I go, and most of the wonderful possessions and furnishings in the Silver Key belong to others already, accepted as collateral for my debts, which I don't intend to pay, of course. Once I leave Buckkeep Town, my creditors will descend like crows and pick those quarters bare, and that will be the end of Lord Golden. I won't be returning to Buckkeep. I won't be returning anywhere."
His voice did not quaver or shake. He spoke calmly, and his eyes met mine. Yet his words left me feeling as if a horse had kicked me. He spoke like a man who knew he was going to die, a man tidying up all the loose ends of his life. I experienced a shift in perception. My awkwardness with him was because of our recent quarrel, and because I knew I deceived him. I did not fear his death, because I knew I had already prevented it. But his discomfort had a different root. He spoke to me as a man who knew he faced death would speak to an old friend who seemed indifferent to the fact. How callous I must have seemed to him, avoiding him all those days. Perhaps he had thought I was carefully severing the contact between us before his death could do it suddenly and painfully. The words burst from me, the only completely true thing I'd said to him that day. "Don't be stupid. I'm not going to let you die, fool." My throat suddenly closed. I picked up my cooling cup of tea and gulped from it hastily. He caught his breath and then laughed, a sound like glass breaking. Tears stood in his eyes.
"You believe that so thoroughly, don't you? Ah, beloved. Of all the things I must bid farewell to, you are the one most difficult to lose. Forgive me that I have avoided you. Better, perhaps, that we make a space between us and become accustomed to it before fate forces that upon us."
I slammed my cup down. Tea splattered the table between us.
"Stop talking like that. Hida and El in a tangle, fool. Is that why you've been squandering your fortune and living like some degenerate Jamalian? Please tell me that you haven't spent all your windfall, and that there is something left for you to come back to."
And there my words halted, as I teetered at the edge of betraying myself. He smiled strangely.
"It's gone, Fitz. It's all gone. Or else arranged to be bestowed. And getting rid of that much wealth has not only been a challenge, but a far greater pleasure than possessing it ever was. I've left papers that Malta is to go to Burwick. Can you imagine his face when someone hands her reins to him? I know he will value her and care for her. And for patience, oh, you should have seen it before I sent it on its way. A cartload of scrolls and books on every imaginable topic. She'll never imagine where they came from. And I've provided for Garetha, my garden maid. I've bought her a cottage and a plot of earth to call her own, as well as left her the coin to keep herself well. That should cause a mild scandal. Folks will wonder why Lord Golden left a garden girl so well endowed. But let them. She will understand, and she won't care. And for Joffrin, my Jumpe friend, I've sent her a selection of fine woods and all of my carving tools. She'll value them and recall me fondly, regardless of how abruptly I left her. She's made her reputation as a toy maker. Did you know that?
As he divulged his generous mischief to me, he smiled, and the shadow of imminent death nearly left his eyes.
"Please stop talking like that," I begged him. "I promise you I won't let you die."
"Make me no promises that can break us both, Fitz. Besides," he took a breath, "even if you manage, against all the foreordained grinding of fate, to keep me alive, well, Lord Golden must still vanish. He's lived to the end of his usefulness. Once I leave here, I shall not be him again." As he spoke on how he'd dismantled his fortune and how his name would fade to obscurity, I felt sick. He had been determined and thorough. When we left him behind on the docks, we'd be leaving him in a difficult situation. That Catrican would provide for him, no matter how he had squandered his wealth, I had no doubt. I resolved to have a quiet word with her before we left, to prepare her to rescue him if need be. Then I reined my thoughts back to the conversation, for the fool was watching me oddly. I cleared my throat and tried to think of sensible words. "I think you are too pessimistic. If you have a coin or two left to your name, you'd best be frugal with it, just in case I'm right, and I keep you alive. And now I must go, for Swift will be waiting for me." He nodded, rising as I did. "Will you come down to my old chambers when it is time for us to meet Chade for the skill lesson?"
"I suppose so," I concurred, trying not to sound reluctant.
He smiled faintly. "Good luck with Burwick's boy," he said, and left. The teacups and charts were still on the table. I suddenly felt too weary to tidy them away, let alone hasten to my lesson with Swift. But I did, and when I arrived on the tower-top garden, he was waiting for me in a square of crenellated sunlight, his back to a chill stone wall, idly playing on a penny whistle. At his feet, several doves bobbed and pecked, and for a moment my heart sank. As I approached, they all took flight, and the handful of grain that had drawn them scattered in the wind. Swift noticed the relief on my face. He took the whistle from his lips and looked up at me. "You thought I was using the wit to draw them in, and it scared you," he observed. I made myself pause before answering him. "I was frightened for a moment," I agreed. "But not at the idea you might be using your wit. Rather, I feared that you were trying to establish a bond with one of them." He shook his head slowly. "No, not with a bird. I've touched minds with birds, and my thoughts glance off their minds like a stone skipping on moving water." Then he smiled condescendingly and added, "Not that I expect you to understand what I mean." I reined myself to silence. Eventually I asked him, "Did you finish reading the scroll about King Slayer and the acquisition of Bairns?" He nodded, and we proceeded with the day's lessons, but his attitude still vexed me. I vented it on the practice court, insisting that he pick up an axe and try his strength against me before I would let him go to his bow lesson. The axes were heavier than I recalled, and even with the heads well muffled in leather wraps, the bruises from such a session are formidable. When he could no longer hold the weapon aloft, I let him go to Cresswell for his bow lesson. Then I punished myself for taking out my temper on the boy by finding a new partner, one seasoned to the axe. When I was well and truly aware of just how rusty my skills were, I left the courts and went briefly to the steams. Cleansed of sweat and frustration, I ate a hasty meal of bread and soup in the guardroom. The talk there was loud and focused on the expedition, out-islander women, and drink. Both were acclaimed strong and palatable. I tried to laugh at the jests, but the single-mindedness of the younger guards made me feel old, and I was glad to excuse myself and hasten back to my workroom. I took the secret passage from there down to the chamber I had occupied when I had been Lord Golden's servant. I listened carefully before I triggered the concealed door. All was quiet on the other side, and I hoped that the fool was not there. But no sooner had I closed the portal to the hidden access than he opened the outer door of the room. I blinked at him. He wore a simple tunic and leggings, all in black with low black shoes. The light from the window gilded his hair. Daylight reached past his silhouette into the tiny room and revealed my old cot, heaped with possessions I had abandoned when I left his service. The wonderful sword he had given me nestled upon a mound of colourful and extravagant garments tailored for me. I gave the fool a puzzled look.
"Those are yours," he said quietly. "You should take them."
"I doubt I'd ever have occasion to dress in such styles again," I said, and then heard how hard a rejection that sounded.
"You never know," he said quietly, looking away. "Perhaps one day Lord Fitzchivalry will again walk the halls of Buckkeep Castle. If he did, those colours and cuts would suit him remarkably well."
"I doubt any of that would ever come to be." That, too, sounded cold, so I tempered it with, "But I thank you all the same. And I will take them, just in case." All the awkwardness fell on me again like a smothering curtain.
"And the sword," he reminded me. "Don't forget the sword. I know it's a bit showy for your taste, but..."
"But it's still one of the finest weapons I've ever drawn. I'll treasure it." I tried to smooth over the slight of my first refusal. I saw now that by leaving it behind when I shifted my den, I'd hurt his feelings.
"Oh, and this. Best that this come back to you now, too."
He reached to unfasten the carved wooden earring that Lord Golden always wore. I knew what was concealed within it. The freedom earring that had passed from Burrick's grandmother to Burrick, to my father, and eventually to me.
"No!" I gripped his wrist. "Stop this funeral rite! I've told you, I've no intention of letting you die."
He stood still.
"Funeral rite,"
he whispered. Then he laughed. I could smell the apricot brandy on his breath.
"Take charge of yourself, fool. This is so unlike you that I scarcely know how to talk to you any more,"
I exclaimed in annoyance, feeling the anger that uneasiness can trigger in a man. "Can't we just relax and be ourselves in the days we have left?"
"The days we have left,"
he echoed. With a twist of his wrist, he effortlessly freed himself from my grip. I followed him back into his large and airy chamber. Stripped of his possessions, it seemed even larger. He went to the brandy decanter and poured more for himself, and then filled a small glass for me. "In the days we have left before we sail," I expanded my words for him as I took the glass. I looked around the chamber. Necessities had been left in place, a table, chairs, a desk. All else was either gone or in the process of being cleared out. Rolled tapestries and rugs were fat sausages against the wall. His workroom stood open, bare and empty, all his secrets tidied away. I walked into the room, brandy in hand. My voice reverberated oddly as I said, "You've eradicated every trace of yourself." He followed, and we stood together looking out of the window.
"I like to leave things tidy. One must leave so many things incomplete in life that I take pleasure in finishing those I can."
"I've never known you to wallow in emotion like this before. It almost seems that you are enjoying this." I tried not to sound disgusted with him. A strange smile twisted his mouth. Then he took a deep breath, as if freed of something.
"Ah, Fitz. In all the world, only you would say something like that to me, and perhaps you are right. There is drama in facing a definite end. I've never encountered these sensations before. Yet, in a like situation, I think you would be untouched by them. You tried to explain to me once how the wolf always lived in the present and taught you to take every possible satisfaction you could from the time that you had. You learned that well. While I, who have always lived trying to define the future before I reach it, I suddenly espy a place beyond which all is black. Blackness. That is what I dream of at night, and when I deliberately sit down and try to reach forward to see where my path might go, that is all I see. Blackness. I did not know what to say to him. I could see him trying to shake off his desperation, as a dog might try to shake a wolf's grip from its throat. I took a sip of the brandy. Apricots and the heady warmth of a summer day flooded me. I recalled our days at my cottage, the brandy on my tongue reawakening the pleasure of that simpler time. "This is very good," I said to him without thinking. Startled, he stared at me. Then he abruptly blinked away tears, and the smile he gave me was genuine. "Yes," he said quietly. "You are right. This is very good brandy, and nothing that is to come can change that. The future cannot take from us the days we have left, unless we let it." He had passed some sort of crossroads within himself, and was more at peace. I took another swallow of the brandy as I stared out over the hills behind Buckkeep. When I glanced at him, he was looking at me with a fondness I could not bear. He would not have looked at me so kindly if he knew how I deceived him. And yet his terror of the days to come only firmed in me my judgment that I had made the best decision for him. Ashamed to rush this, but Chade and the others will be waiting. He nodded gravely, lifted his glass in a small toast to me, and then tossed off the brandy. I followed his example, and then had to stand still while the liquor spread heat throughout me. I took a deep breath, smelling and tasting apricots. "It is very good," I told him again. He smiled, small. "I'll leave all the remaining bottles to you," he offered very quietly, and then laughed when I glared at him, yet his step seemed lighter as he followed me through the labyrinth of corridors and stairs that threaded between the walls of Buckkeep. As I moved through the dimness, I wondered how I truly would feel. Did I know the hour and day of my death? Unlike Lord Golden, there would be very few possessions for me to disperse. I numbered my treasures to myself, thinking I owned nothing of significance to anyone but myself. Then I realized abruptly it wasn't true. With a pang of selfish regret, I resolved to correct that. We reached the concealed entrance to the Sea-Watch Tower. I unseated the panel, and we emerged from the hearth. The others had already gathered, so I had no opportunity for a private word to prepare Chade. Instead, as we stepped out, the prince exclaimed with delight and came forward to welcome Lord Golden. Thick was more cautious, scowling suspiciously. Chade sent me one glance full of rebuke, and then smoothed his face and exchanged greetings with the fool. But after that first moment of welcome, awkwardness ensued. Thick, unsettled by having a stranger in our midst, wandered aimlessly about the room instead of settling into his place at the table. I could almost see the prince trying to fit Lord Golden, even dressed so simply, into the role of King Shrewd's fool, as he had heard the queen tell the tale. Chade finally said, almost bluntly, "So, my dear fellow, what brings you here to join us? It's wonderful to see you, of course, but we've still much to learn and little time in which to learn it." "I understand," the fool replied. "But there is also little time for me to share with you what I know, so I came hoping for a bit of your time, privately, after the lesson." "I think it's wonderful that you've come," the prince broke in artlessly. "I think you should have been included from the first. You were the one who let us link our strength and go through you to heal Tom. You've as much right to be a member of this coterie as anyone here." The fool looked touched by Dutiful's comments. He looked down at his hands, neatly gloved in black, rubbed his fingertips together almost idly, and then admitted, "I don't have any true skill of my own. I only used what was left of the touch I'd taken from Verity, and my own knowledge of Tom." At the mention of his father's name, the prince had perked up like a foxhound catching a scent. He leaned closer to the fool, as if his knowledge of King Verity was something that could be absorbed from him. "Nonetheless," he assured Lord Golden, "I look forward to journeying with you. I think you may be a valuable member of this coterie, regardless of your level of skill. Will not you join us for the day's lesson and let us explore the extent of your ability?" I saw Chade torn. The fool offered a possibility of greater power for the coterie, which Chade craved, but he feared the fool's opposition to our basic mission to take the dragon's head. I wondered if there was an element of jealousy in how his eyes darted from the fool to me.
The Fool and I had always been close, and Chade knew he wielded a friend's sway over me. Yet now, more than ever, Chade desired to rule me. His greed for the skill won out. He added his voice to Dutiful's. "Please, Lord Golden, take a seat with us. If nothing else, you may find our efforts amusing."
"Well then, I shall,"
the Fool declared, almost gladly. He pulled out a chair and sat down expectantly. I wondered if any of the others could see the darker tides running behind the placid affability he presented to them. Chade and I took the chairs on either side of him while Dutiful persuaded Thick to come and join us at the table. When he was settled, four of us simultaneously took a deep breath and reached for that state of openness where we could all reach the skill. As we did so, I had an insight both affirming and alarming. The Fool was an intruder here. In our short time of striving to become a coterie, we had achieved a unity. I had not perceived it until the Fool interrupted it. As I joined my awareness to Dutiful's and Thick's, I could feel Chade fluttering like a frantic butterfly at the edge of our union. Thick reached a reassuring hand to draw him into firmer contact with the rest of us. He belonged with us, but the Fool did not. He was not so much a presence as an absence. I had noticed years ago that he was invisible to my wit sense. Now, as I deliberately reached towards him with a skill, it was like trying to lift sun dazzle off a still pond.
"Lord Golden, do you avoid us?" Chade asked, very softly.
"I am here," he replied.
His words seemed to ripple softly in the room, as if I felt them as well as heard them.
"Give me your hand," Chade suggested.
He set his own, palm up on the table, outstretched towards my friend. It seemed as much a challenge as an invitation. I felt a minuscule tickle of fear. It quivered along the skill bond between the Fool and me, letting me know that link still existed. Then the Fool lifted his gloved hand and set it in Chade's. I could feel him then, but not in any way that is easy to describe. If our combined skill was a quiet pool, then the Fool was a leaf floating upon it.
"Reach for him," Chade suggested,
and we all did. My awareness of the Fool's uneasiness grew stronger via our bond, but I did not think the others could sense that. They could almost touch him, but he parted before them and joined after them, as if they dragged their fingers through water. It disturbed his presence without making it accessible to them. His fear intensified. I reached along our bond surreptitiously, trying to discover what frightened him. Possession. He did not wish to be touched in a way that might let another possess him. Belatedly, I recalled what Regal and his coterie had once done to him. They had found him, through the link I shared with him, and taken a bit of his consciousness and used it against me, to spy upon me and gain knowledge of Molly's whereabouts. That betrayal still shamed and pained him. He still carried that burden of guilt for something that had happened so long ago. It stabbed deeper that soon he would know that I had betrayed him as well.
"It wasn't your fault," I offered him comfort through our link.
He refused it. Then, as if from a distance and yet clear, his thoughts reached mine.
"I knew it would happen. I'd foretold it myself when I was a child, that the one closest to you would betray you. Yet I could not believe that it would be me, and so I fulfilled my own prophecy.
We all survived. Barely."
"Are you skilling to one another?" Chade asked testily. I both heard and felt his words. I took a deeper breath and sank deeper into the skill. "Yes," I breathed. "I can reach him, but only just. And only because we have been skill-linked before."
"Would you have more than this?"
The Fool's voice was less than a whisper. I discerned a challenge in his words, but could not understand it.
"Yes, please. Try," I bade him.
Beside me at the table I was aware of the Fool making some small movement, but my vision was unfocused on the room, and I had no warning of his intentions until his hand settled on my wrist. His fingertips unerringly found their own faded grey fingerprints, left on my flesh so many years ago. His touch was gentle, but the sensation was an arrow in my heart. I physically spasmed, a speared fish, and then froze.
The full ran through my veins, hot as liquor, cold as ice. For a flashing instant, we shared physical awareness. The intensity of it went beyond any joining I'd ever experienced. It was more intimate than a kiss and deeper than a knife thrust, beyond a skill link and beyond sexual coupling, even beyond my wit bond with Night Eyes. It was not a sharing, it was a becoming. Neither pain nor pleasure could encompass it. Worse, I felt myself turning and opening to it as if it were my lover's mouth upon mine. And yet, I did not know if I would devour or be devoured. In another heartbeat, we would be one another. Know one another more perfectly than two separate beings ever should. He'd know my secret. No! I cried, before he could discover my plot against him. I wrenched myself free, mind and body. For a long time, I fell, until I struck the cold stone floor. I rolled under the table to escape that touch, gasping. My time of blackness seemed to last for hours, yet it was only an instant before Chade dragged my curled body from under the table. He propped me against his chest as he knelt beside me. Dimly I was aware of him demanding, "What happened? Are you hurt? What did you do to him, fool?" I heard a sob escape thick. He alone, perhaps, had sensed what had transpired. Prickling shiver ran over my body. I could not see anything. Then I realized my eyes were tightly clenched shut. My body huddled in a ball. Knowing those things, it still took me a time to persuade myself I could change them. Just as I opened my eyes, the fool's thought uncurled in my mind like leaf opening to sunlight. And I set no limits on that love. "It's too much," I said brokenly. "No one can give that much. No one." "Here's brandy," Dutiful said close by me. It was Chade who hauled me into a sitting position and put the cup to my lips. I gulped it as if it were water, then wheezed with the shock. When I managed to turn my head, the fool was the only one still sitting in his chair at the table. His hands were gloved again, and the look he gave me was opaque. Thick crouched in a corner of the room, hugging himself and shivering. His skill music was his mother's song, a desperate attempt to comfort himself. "What happened?" Chade demanded in a fierce voice. I still leaned against his chest, and I could feel the anger emanating from him, like heat. I knew he directed his accusatory glare at the fool, but I answered anyway. "It was too intense. We formed a skill link that was so complete I couldn't find myself. As if we'd become one being." I called it the skill, yet I was not sure that was a proper name for it. "As well call a spark the sun." I took a deeper breath. It scared me. So I broke free of it. I wasn't expecting anything like that. And those words were spoken as much to the fool as to the others. I saw him hear them, but I think he took a different message from them than what I had intended. "And it affected you not at all?" Chade demanded of him. Dutiful helped me to my feet. I needed his aid. I sank down into a chair almost immediately, yet it was not weariness I felt, but a loose energy. I could have scaled Buckkeep's highest tower if I could have recalled how to make my knees bend. "It affected me," the fool said quietly, "but in a different way." He met my eyes and said, "It didn't frighten me." "Shall we try it again?" Dutiful proposed, innocently. And "No," Chade, the fool, and I all replied with varying degrees of emphasis. "No," the fool repeated more quietly, in the tiny silence that followed. "For myself, I've learned enough today."
"Perhaps we all have," Chade concurred gruffly. He cleared his throat and went on. "It's time we dispersed to our own tasks, anyway."
"We've still plenty of time," Dutiful protested.
"Ordinarily, yes, that would be so," Chade agreed. "But the day's run away from us now. You've much to do to prepare for our journey, Dutiful. Rehearse your speech thanking the Out-Islanders for their welcome again.
Remember, the "kh" is sounded toward the back of the throat."
"I've read it 100 times now," Dutiful groaned.
"And when the time comes, the words must seem to come from your heart, not from a scroll." Dutiful nodded grudgingly to this.
He gave one longing look at the bright and breezy day outside the window.
"Off you both go, then," Chade told him,
and it was suddenly clear he was dismissing both Thick and Dutiful. Disappointment crossed the prince's face. He turned to Lord Golden.
"When we are at sea and have more time and fewer tasks, I'd like to hear of your time with my father. If you wouldn't mind, I know that you cared for him when he...
at the end of his days."
"I did,"
the fool replied gently.
"And I'd be glad to share my memories of those days with you."
"Thank you," Dutiful replied. He went to the corner and gently chivied Thick along, asking him what on earth had frightened him, for no one had been hurt. I was grateful that Thick had no intelligible answer to that. They were nearly at the door when I recalled my earlier resolution. "Prince Dutiful, would you come to my workroom this evening? I've something for you." He raised an eyebrow, but when I said no more, he replied,
"I'll find time. I'll see you then."
Dutiful left with Thick trudging at his heels, but at the door Thick turned and gave the fool an oddly appraising look before he transferred his gaze to me. I wondered uneasily how much he had sensed of what had passed between me and the fool. Then Thick was gone, shutting the door rather too firmly behind himself. For a moment, I feared that Chade would demand to know more of what had happened. But before he could speak, the fool said,
"Prince Dutiful must not kill Icefire. That is the most important thing that I must tell you, Chade. At all costs, the dragon's life must be preserved."
Chade had crossed to the bottles of spirits. He selected one, poured from it silently, and then turned back to us.
"As the creature is frozen in a glacier, don't you think it might be a bit late to worry about preserving his life?"
He sipped from his glass.
"Or do you truly think that any beast could survive that long, bereft of warmth, water, and food?"
The fool lifted his shoulders and shook his head.
"What do any of us know of dragons? How long had the stone dragons slept before fits woke them? If they share any of their natures with true dragons, then perhaps some spark of life still grows within Icefire."
"What do you know of Icefire?"
Chade demanded suspiciously. He came back to the table and sat down. I remained standing, watching the two of them.
"I know no more of him than you do, Chade."
"Then why forbid us the taking of his head, when you know the Narcheska has demanded this as a condition of the marriage? Or do you think that the world would be set into a better path if our two realms remained at each other's throats for another century or two?"
I winced at his sarcasm. Never would I have mocked the fool's stated goal to change the world. It shocked me that Chade did, and made me realize the depth of his antagonism.
"I've no love of strife, Chade Falstar,"
the fool replied softly.
"Yet even a war amongst men is not the worst thing that can occur. Better war than we do deeper, graver damage to the world itself, especially when we have the briefest grasp at a chance to repair an almost irreparable wrong. Which is? If Icefire lives, and I concede it would be surpassing strange if he did, but if there is some spark of life in him yet, we must abandon all other quests to free him from the ice and restore him to full life."
"Why?"
"You haven't told him?"
He swung an accusing gaze to me. I didn't meet it, and he didn't wait for me to reply.
"Tintaglia, the Bingtown dragon, is the sole adult female dragon in the world. With every passing year, it becomes more apparent that the young ones which emerge from their cases will remain stunted and weak, unable to hunt or fly. Dragons mate in flight. If the hatchlings never fly, they can never mate. Dragons will die out in the world. And this time, it will be forever. Unless there remains one fully formed male dragon, one who could rise to mate Tintaglia and sire a new generation of dragons."
I had told Chade all those things. Did he ask his questions to test the fool's frankness?
"You are telling me,"
Chade enunciated carefully,
that we must put peace between the Out-Islands and the Six Duchies at risk for the sake of reviving dragons. And this will benefit us how?
It won't, the fool admitted. On the contrary, it will present many drawbacks for men, and many adjustments. Dragons are an arrogant and aggressive species. They ignore boundaries and have no concept of ownership. If a hungry dragon sees a cow in a pen, he'll eat it. To them, it's simple. The world provides, and you take what you need from it.
Chade smiled archly. Then perhaps I should do the same on behalf of humanity. The world has provided us a time free of dragons. I think I shall take it.
I watched the fool. He was not upset by Chade's words. For the space of two breaths, he held his peace. Then he said, "As you will, sir. But when the time comes, that decision may not be yours. It may be mine. Or Fitz's."
As Chade's eyes blazed with anger, he added, "And not only the world, but humanity itself does need dragons."
"And why is that?" Chade demanded disdainfully.
"To keep the balance," the fool replied.
He glanced over at me, and then past me, out of the window, and his eyes went far and pensive. "Humanity fears no rivals. You have forgotten what it was to share the world with creatures as arrogantly superior as yourselves. You think to arrange the world to your liking, so you map the land and draw lines across it, claiming ownership simply because you can draw a picture of it. The plants that grow and the beasts that rove, you mark as your own, claiming not only what lives today, but what might grow tomorrow to do with as you please. Then, in your conceit and aggression, you wage wars and slay one another over the lines you have imagined on the world's face.
And I suppose dragons are better than we are, because they don't do such things, because they simply take whatever they see, free spirits, nature's creatures, possessing all the moral loftiness that comes from not being able to think.
The fool shook his head, smiling. No, dragons are no better than humans. They are little different at all from men. They will hold up a mirror to humanity's selfishness. They will remind you that all your talk of owning this and claiming that is no more than the snarling of a chained dog or a sparrow's challenge song. The reality of those claims lasts but for the instant of its sounding. Name it as you will. Claim it as you will. The world does not belong to men. Men belong to the world. You will not own the earth that eventually your body will become, nor will it recall the name it once answered to.
Chade did not reply immediately. I thought he was stunned by the fool's words, his view of reality reordered by them. But then he snorted disdainfully.
"Pish! What you say only makes it plainer to me that no good will be worked for anyone by resurrecting this dragon."
He rubbed his eyes wearily.
"Oh, why do we bother with this fatuous debate? None of us knows what we will find when we get there. It's all philosophical ramblings and nursery tales at this point. When I confront it, then I will think about what is best to do. There. Does that satisfy you?
I scarcely believe that my satisfaction matters to you." And as he spoke those odd words, the fool sent a sidelong glance my way. But it was not a look to catch my eye, but rather one that pointed me out to Chade.
"You're right," Chade agreed smoothly. "It is not your satisfaction, but Fitz's agreement that matters to me. Yet I know that if this decision falls to him alone, he would give your satisfaction much weight, even perhaps at the risk of farseer fortunes."
My old master gave me a speculative look, as if I were a spavined horse that might or might not last through another battle. The smile he gave me was almost desperate.
"Yet I hope he will hear my concerns as well."
His gaze met mine.
"When we confront it, then we will decide. Until then,
The choice remains open. Is that acceptable?
Almost, the fool replied. His voice was cool as he proposed. Give us your promise as a farseer that when the time comes, Fitz may do as his judgment bids him.
My promise as a farseer?
Chade was incensed.
Exactly,
the fool replied calmly.
Unless your words are just an empty sop thrown to keep Fitz on the path to doing your will.
He leaned back in his chair, his wrists and hands lax on the arms of it, perfectly at ease. For a moment I recognized that slender man in black with his shining hair bound back. This was the boy the fool had been, grown to a man. Then he turned his head to regard Chade more directly, and the familiarity was gone. His face was a sculpted silhouette of determination. I had never seen anyone challenge Chade so confidently. I was shocked at the words Chade spoke then. His smile was very strange as his eyes went from me to the fool and back again. It was my gaze he met as he said,
I give my word as a farseer. I will not ask him to do anything against his will. There. Are you content, man?
The fool nodded slowly.
Oh, yes, I am content. For the decision will come to him, and that I see as clearly as anything that remains to me to see.
He nodded to himself.
There are still things we must discuss, you and I, but once we are on board ship and underway, there will be time for that. But the day rushes on without us, and I still have much to do to prepare for my departure. Good day, Lord Falstar.
A very slight smile hung about his mouth. His glance went from me to Chade, and then he made a most curious gesture.
Sweeping his arms wide, he made a graceful bow to Chade, as if they had afforded one another some great courtesy.
When he straightened, he spoke to me. His tone was warmer. It was good to have a few moments with you today, Fitz. I've missed you. Then he gave a sudden small sigh, as if he had recalled an unpleasant duty. I suspected that his predicted death had just pushed itself to the forefront of his mind. His smile faded.
Gentlemen, you will excuse me,
he murmured, and he departed, exiting through the cramped panel concealed in the side of the hearth as gracefully as a lord departing a banquet. I sat staring after him. Our recent skill encounter rattled in my mind with his strange words and stranger gestures. He had clashed with Chade over something, and triumphed, yet I was not quite sure what, if anything, had just been settled between them. My old mentor spoke, as if he could hear my thoughts.
He challenges me for your loyalty. How dare he? Me, who practically raised you! How can he think there would be any chance of us disagreeing, when we both know how much rests upon the successful completion of this quest? My word, as a farseer, indeed. And what does he think you are, when all is said and done?
He turned and put the question to me as if he expected an unthinking assent from me. Perhaps, I said quietly, he believes that he is the White Prophet, and I am his catalyst. Then I took a stronger breath, and spoke a question of my own.
How can the two of you quarrel over my loyalty as if I had no thought of my own to give to any decision I might make?
I gave a snort of disgust. I would not think a horse or a dog as mindless a game piece as you both seem to think I am. He was staring past me out of the window when he spoke, and I do not think he truly considered the import of his words. Not a horse or a dog, Fitz, no. I'd never think of you that way. No. You're a sword. So you were made to be, by me, a weapon to be wielded. And he thinks you fit his hand the best.
The old man snorted in contempt. The man is still